Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading articles this week from True West Magazine's archives. August 2004 edition. Luck of the Draw by John Harridan. General Santa Anna ordered every single Texan prisoner executed. Men fighting for the Republic of Texas. A total of 214 of them had been captured in December 1842 on the south bank of the Rio Grande in Mier, Tamaulipas, Mexico. The Mexican army then marched them south to Salado, where the Texans decided they had gone far enough, if not too far, into the country. The Texans had been retaliating for Mexican attacks around San Antonio, known then as West Texas, and the capture of their fellow Texans by Mexican General Adrian Wohl's 1,400-man army, which seized the city on September 11, 1842. Alarmed by the invasion, Texans rushed to form volunteer militias. Texans under General Alexander Somerville soon marched south, capturing Laredo and Guerrero, but abandoned their mission on December 19, 1842, when the general decided it was too late to catch Wohl. About 300 men refused to retreat and instead crossed the Rio Grande River on Christmas Day and attacked the Mexican border town of Mier. Even though they had only lost 30 men to the Mexican 600, the Texans surrendered because they were low on ammunition. After spending almost 2 months in prison, the Texans escaped on February 11, 1843. The escapees disarmed 150 Mexican infantrymen, killed a number of guards, stole horses, and put the Mexican cavalry to flight. Unfortunately, most of the Texans then got lost. Bigfoot Wallace described their plight under the scorching sun. The suffering of men became so intolerable that many of them, to relieve themselves of all superfluous weight, threw away their guns and equipment. Many of the men gave out entirely and laid down by the wayside to die. Still, the rest of us struggled on, hoping that our strength might hold out until we came to water. They finally got their drink of water, but it was after accidentally wandering into a camp of Mexican soldiers. Within days of their escape, 176 Texans were recaptured and sent back to prison, where they learned of Mexican President Santa Anna's wrath. The Bruce of the West. But luckily for some, Coahuila Governor Francisco Mejia refused to carry out Santa Anna's ordered execution, and several foreign ministers to Mexico got the decree modified to more humane terms, that only one man in ten be executed. In an earthen pot were placed 176 beans, 159 white and 17 black. Prison commander Colonel Dominic Huerta had the Texans chained in pairs and blindfolded. They were marched out as an officer approached with the olla containing the beans. For a few moments, the Texans stood silent, and then the drawing began. The jar was held up so that no one could see inside. The officers drew first. Eager to kill Captain Ewan Cameron, once hailed as the Bruce of the West, the Mexicans had put all the black beans on top and made Cameron lead off. They had a reason to want the Scottish-born Cameron dead. He was the kind to persevere. During the battle at Mier, when the Mexican soldiers had charged at Cameron, he emptied his rifles into them and then threw rocks, forcing the soldados to take cover until he could reload. During the second day of fighting, a majority of the Texans voted to surrender and laid their guns in the street. Cameron, however, rushed back to his position and urged his men to keep fighting. Some 50 of them stood their ground. Cameron's unit held its position until Cameron saw that all hope was gone. He looked around at his men and said, "Boys, it is no use for us to continue the fight. They are all gone but us." Only then did he break his sword and surrender. So the Mexicans knew Cameron was tough. Better luck next time. But now one of Cameron's men suspected the Mexicans had rigged the beans against Cameron. So when Cameron approached the jug, he was warned, "Dig deep, Captain." Cameron plunged his hand to the bottom and pulled out a white bean. The Mexicans were disappointed. The rest of the drawing was done in alphabetical order and went rapidly. Although the men knew that 17 of them would die, they could not help showing their joy as friend after friend drew a life-saving white bean. And they showed their sorrow, too, as someone who had fought beside them drew a black bean. To these unfortunates, the Mexicans sarcastically wished them better luck next time. As the list dwindled down to the W's, there were 2 black beans and 4 white beans left. Bigfoot Wallace, who had rushed to Texas after losing a brother and cousin in the Goliad massacre, had been watching as the beans were drawn and thought that the black beans were a little larger than the white ones. When his turn came, he scooped up 2 beans and felt them between his fingers, while a Mexican officer told him to hurry up. Wallace finally dropped 1 bean and pulled out the other. It was white. The next 2 men to draw, Martin Wing and Henry Whalen, both drew black beans. Those were the last of the black beans, and the final 3 men on the list did not draw. The condemned men were immediately separated from the others and given a chance to write home. The surprise deaths. After drawing a fatal bean, Whalen reportedly said, "Well, they don't make much off me anyhow, for I know I have killed 25 of the yellow bellies." Whalen then asked the Mexicans for a good last meal, saying, "I do not wish to starve and be shot too." Surprisingly, the Mexicans gave him a double ration, which he ate with great enjoyment, and then declared himself ready to die. At about 6:30 p.m. on March 25, 1843, 9 of the condemned men were chained together and shot. The remaining 8 were then executed in the same manner. In all, the killing took roughly 11 minutes. Henry Whalen received 15 shots before life was extinct and continued cursing the Mexicans until someone blew out his brains with a pistol. The following morning, as the Mexicans prepared to bury the bodies in a mass grave, 1 corpse was discovered missing. 17-year-old James L. Shepard had been only wounded and, under the cover of darkness, escaped. 3 days later, he was captured in Saltillo and fatally shot. Chained to fate. The remaining Texans left Salado on March 26th, first marching to San Luis Potosi and then toward Mexico City. On April 24th, the prisoners arrived at the Huatoca. On Santa Anna's orders, Cameron was taken from his companions at midnight and shot the next morning. When the prisoners arrived in Mexico City, they were compelled to build a 4-mile road to Santa Anna's palace at Tacubaya. They spent 6 months completing the road before being moved to Santiago Prison and then back to Perote Prison. For 18 months, Santa Anna teased Texas President Sam Houston with the prisoners, first offering to free them and then finding some new reason to keep them in chains. On September 12, 1844, Santa Anna finally issued an order for their release. Of the 261 men who had fought in Mir, 84 died, 35 escaped, and 142 were eventually set free. Former prisoner Thomas Jefferson Green moved to California in 1849 and served in California's first Senate, sponsoring the bill that created the University of California. He later became Major General in the California Militia. Bigfoot Wallace had a long, distinguished career as a scout and Texas Ranger. Samuel Walker joined Jack Hayes' company of Rangers in 1844. During one fight, Walker and 14 other Rangers used the new Colt Peterson revolvers to successfully defeat 80 Comanches. Walker then joined General Zachary Taylor's army as a scout, fighting in the Battle of Monterey in September 1846. In October, he visited Samuel Colt, proposing improvements, including a fixed trigger and guard to Colt's Peterson's revolver. The new six-shooter was aptly named the Walker Colt. As for the condemned men, one of them, James Masterson Ogden, left behind a farewell letter that speaks to the courage of the Texas soldiers. "Tell my mother not to grieve for me," he wrote, "for the friend that I love is with me, and my God will not forsake me. Give my love to all, and tell them to meet me in heaven. I am indebted for the favor of dying with my hands untied. Farewell, all, farewell." True West, August 2004 edition. Judging the Peace by Megan Saar. The Rustlers knew the Neutrality Act of 1818 forbade American military expeditions into countries at peace with the United States. And in 1875, the U.S. and Mexico were at peace. In fairness, the Mexicans did not recognize the border. Texans regularly raided into Mexico, stealing cattle, and the outlaws may have felt they were just giving a little tit for tat. As McNally saw it, his war was with the outlaws, not with Mexico, which was merely their hideout. So in November that year, he finally ordered his men to cross the border into Mexico, acting on a tip that thieves would be rustling cattle to fulfill an 18,000-head contract. But the Rangers attacked the wrong ranch, shooting down innocent men. By the time they reached the intended bandit ranch, Las Cuevas, 250 Mexicans awaited them, on full alert. Outnumbered, the Rangers fled, only to encounter the ranch's leader, General Juan Flores Salinas, and his men. During the ensuing gunfight, Salinas was killed, though the two sides eventually negotiated a truce, which called for the Rangers to leave Mexico. The bandits returned 65 head of stolen cattle the following day, which McNally's men delivered to the rightful Texas owners. "Tell them, Mr. Attorney General, that there was peace." A former Confederate hero, McNally had been sick with tuberculosis when Texas Governor Richard Koch picked him to lead the Special Force of Rangers. Because McNally died from the disease the following year, he never stood trial for his neutrality violation. But 129 years later, McNally's actions have finally been aired in court. If the U.S. had charged him with violating the Neutrality Act, how would the captain have fared in court? A judge was asked to decide just that on May 8, 2004, in the Texas Ranger Hall of Fame and Museums Theater, which served as a courtroom for Baylor Law School's mock trial. A mock trial is a history lesson brought to life, meant to be an informative and entertaining way of presenting our story to the public, says Gerald Powell, Abner V. McCall Professor of Evidence at Baylor Law School in Waco, Texas, next door to the Texas Ranger Museum. The unscripted trial contained testimony based on witnesses' congressional statements and other documents authored by them, but no documents directly addressed McNally's orders. Was he ordered to cross the river if he felt it necessary, or was that his idea? Defense lead counsel Powell says in the trial's unresolved question. What the evidence did show is McNally disobeying repeated orders not to cross the border, a fact the prosecution made the crux of its case, claiming McNally alone had decided what was good for the country. But the defense insisted McNally was a hero. Prior to the Ranger invasion, Adjutant General William Steele had written to Governor Koch that, barring other measures, the person stationed at the Rio Grande should have the authority to pursue bandits across the river. And at the time, that person was McNally. Koch had given a similar order almost a year before McNally was sent to the region. The governor gave state militia Captain Refugio Benavidez permission to cross the Rio Grande in pursuit of raiders, defending his order as one of necessity and self-defense. Minus a good spy network, Benavidez never had the opportunity to cross. Also admitted into evidence were documents of a border crossing that passed without penalty and occurred about two decades earlier. When Jack Rip Ford and his Rangers caught then-bandit leader Juan Cortina in the act of cattle rustling in 1860, they pursued him and his men across the border. The Rangers' orders came from U.S. Army Major Samuel Heintzelman, whose federal troops weren't allowed to cross the border. Authorizing the Rangers to cross was apparently left to Heintzelman's discretion, and he wasn't one to oppose the idea. McNally, however, didn't have a federal superior on his side when he crossed, or at least there's no known document to prove he did. Because a case isn't won on circumstantial evidence, the defense made its case by asking the jury to focus on the language of the Neutrality Act, especially the word peace. Was McNally chasing people with whom the U.S. was at peace, or outlaws using Mexico as their safe harbor? Ask yourself if there was peace on the Rio Grande frontier, argued the defense. Read about the brutal murder of Thaddeus Swift, the mutilation of his wife's body by the knives of Mexican bandits. Tell their family, Mr. Attorney General, that there was peace in Refugio County in the summer of 1874. When Mexican raiders murdered the postmaster, J.L. Fulton, robbed his store, murdered his clerk, Marcio Villanueva, tell their families, Mr. Attorney General, there was peace in Hidalgo County in February of 1875. Read about the bold raid of over 100 miles into Texas, almost to Corpus Christi. Tell the Noakes family, Mr. Attorney General, that there was peace in Nueces County on Good Friday, 1875. Tell the citizens of Corpus Christi that when they were in their churches that Easter morning praying for deliverance from the raiders on the outskirts of town, tell them, Mr. Attorney General, that there was peace. Whether or not there will be law and order along the Rio Grande is up to the jury, the members were told. If they decide a guilty verdict, they'll be telling those on both sides of the river, maybe you better give up your hopes and your dreams, because the Mexican government can't protect you, the U.S. government won't protect you, and the Texas Rangers won't be allowed to protect you. If those families were here today, they would have found a jury that recognized there was no peace along the Rio Grande, and that the region sorely needed McNally's Rangers to restore order. The defense's argument won over the trial's audience jury, which returned with a verdict of 50 guilty and 163 not guilty. The judge declared McNally mostly not guilty. Although McNally's jaunt across the border didn't end the cattle rustling, he did send the Mexican bandits a pointed message. No one taunted him and his Rangers and got away with it. McNally could at least be satisfied that the stolen beeves had returned to graze Texas pastures where they belonged. True West Magazine, August 2004 edition. Legendary Rancher by Tom Carpenter. Anybody wanting to find him had to negotiate the narrow confines of Grapevine Canyon and ride up to his front door. Anybody thinking about sneaking up behind Tap had a bigger canyon to negotiate. The western rim of Grand Canyon lies 5 miles east of the ranch. At the edge, it's a mile straight down to the Colorado River. Tap had reason to keep the back door shut and the front door narrow. George Taplin Duncan was born in San Saba, Texas, on February 4, 1869. The Duncan family was a tough bunch. His older brother Richard was hanged for murder in 1892. That same year, Tap married Ollie Binion. He and Ollie moved to Idaho, and Tap got into the cattle business. It was during this time that Tap became associated with Harvey Logan and other members of the Hole in the Wall gang. The extent of Tap's involvement with the gang is unclear. But in 1898, Tapp killed a man in a barroom fight. He left Idaho in a hurry with Ollie and their four children and bought a ranch on Knight Creek near Hackberry, Arizona. On June 7, 1904, three men held up the Denver and Rio Grande No. 5 outside Parachute, Colorado. A posse cornered the robbers 2 days later near Rifle, Colorado. In the ensuing shootout, one of the men, Harvey Logan, a.k.a. Kid Curry, was severely wounded. With no chance to escape, Logan convinced his two accomplices to make a run for it while he held off the posse. When the shooting stopped, the posse found Logan dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. The posse identified the dead man as Tapp Duncan. Pinkerton agents investigating the train robbery recognized that the dead man was actually Harvey Logan. The railroad didn't want to pay the reward, so the agents confirmed that the dead man was Tapp Duncan. He was buried in Glenwood Springs, and the legend was born that Logan had fled the country to join his friends Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in South America. If Tapp got wind of all this, he never said. On November 19, 1944, he died at the age of 75 in Kingman, Arizona, 40 years after the man buried in Tapp's grave in Glenwood Springs, Harvey Logan. The Mysterious Mr. Thomas. Tired of the bitter cold Idaho winters, Tapp and Ollie Duncan and five other families formed a wagon train and headed for Arizona in 1898. Crossing the Colorado River at Bonelli Landing, a local guide, Ella Grounds, met them and guided them into Mojave Country. Riding with the Duncan party was a man who called himself Mr. Thomas. Grounds observed that the dark-complexioned cowboy rode a nice saddle, wore good clothes, and hung off to the side when they stopped to eat. Grounds also noted that when they approached the town of White Hills, Thomas rode away from the road and rejoined the outfit on the other side of town. The mysterious and aloof cowboy referred to Mr. Duncan as Aunt Ollie. In actuality, Thomas was the outlaw, Tom Blackjack Ketchum, and Tapp Duncan's older brother, Beege, was married to Ketchum's sister. Sometime after their arrival, Ketchum allegedly held up a store near Kingman, Arizona, then fled, and with others, robbed a general store in Camp Verde, killing the owner. A series of bank and train holdups followed, until Ketchum finally was captured near Folsom, New Mexico, tried, and sentenced to hang. When Ketchum was hanged at Clayton, New Mexico in 1903, the local newspaper reported that a raid to free Ketchum was expected, and rumors circulated it would be led by a cowboy named Tapp Duncan. The raid never materialized. Diamond Bar Ranch. Located some 50 miles as the crow flies, northeast of Kingman, Arizona, between the Grand Canyon and the second largest Joshua tree forest in the state. Archaeological evidence indicates the natural springs on the ranch have been in use for 3,000 years. In 1889, the first of several ghost dances by the Huapai were held at these springs. These dances were intended to bring back to life deceased Indians and game animals and do away with the encroaching white men. The ranch was established by a Mormon rancher, W. Starkey, in the late 1800s. Tapp Duncan purchased it in 1910. He gradually expanded the ranch until, at its most productive, he was running 2,000 head of cattle on more than 2,265 sections, approximately 1.45 million acres. What remains of the ranch is now part of the 106,000-acre Grand Canyon West Ranch, a working cattle ranch and guest resort. True West, August 2004. Pike's Peak or Bust by Candy Moulton. On the first day of summer in 1850, John Beck, a Cherokee preacher en route to California's gold fields, stopped to do a little panning along the Front Range of the Colorado Rockies, near where what would become Denver. He found a few flecks of color, but he didn't think the stream would pay adequately for his efforts, so he continued on toward California. A few years later, Beck had left California and corresponded with William Green Russell in Georgia, who had also been in California during the gold rush, and the two organized a return trip west in the spring of 1858. They struck out along the Cherokee Trail, adding new members to their gold-seeking party until it numbered 104 prospectors by the time they stopped at what became Cherry Creek on June 24, 1858. Success didn't happen overnight, and by July 6th, only 13 men, including Russell, were present when they found color in their gold pans. At the same time, a group of men from Lawrence, Kansas, who had heard about the gold from Fall Leaf, a Delaware Indian who saw it while on a military reconnaissance in 1857, also headed west. They reached Pike's Peak a couple of weeks after Russell's party had stopped farther north. The Lawrence men hunted and searched for gold to no avail. Russell's men tried to keep their find quiet, but on August 26th, word of the discovery hit the newsprint of the Journal of Commerce in Kansas City. The New El Dorado, gold in Kansas Territory, the Pike's Mines, first arrival of gold dust in Kansas City. Mountain trader James Bordeaux brought the news from the diggings when he returned to Kansas City to obtain tools and outfits necessary for working the gold-laden streams. They bring several ounces of gold dug up by the trappers of that region, which in fineness equals the choicest of California specimens, the Journal of Commerce reported. Mr. John Cantrell, an old citizen of Westport, has 3 ounces, which he dug with a hatchet in Cherry Creek and washed out with a frying pan, the paper added. Soon, word of the Colorado gold had been published in St. Louis and Boston newspapers, and the rush was on as people threw their mining tools and supplies into wagons, tied on signs that said, Pike's Peak or bust, and headed west. At that time, gold had not actually been found on Pike's Peak, or even nearby, but that was the most recognizable point, and it became an identifying landmark. Unsuccessful farther south, the Lawrence Party moved north and organized the Montana Town Company on September 7, 1858, but they abandoned it within a year. Some Lawrence men also organized the St. Charles Association on September 24th, and with it a town site on the South Platte, about 5 miles from the mouth of Cherry Creek. Meantime, the Auraria Town Company organized on Cherry Creek on October 30th, and then the Denver City Town Company organized on November 22nd. Long before Auraria and Denver were the strongest rivals, eventually merging into Denver City, the name coming from Kansas Governor James W. Denver. It then became the central commercial hub for all gold seekers. Gregory Goldstrike. In January 1859, independent miners struck gold in 3 additional locations. George A. Jackson on the 7th, while hunting for deer, found gold in Chicago Creek as it entered Clear Creek at what became Idaho Springs. John Gregory found gold in mid-January near Gregory Gulch at what became Black Hawk. 6 men struck gold on the 16th at the mouth of Boulder Canyon at the foot of Gold Hill. By June 1st, Gregory Gulch was crowded with canvas tents, log shanties, and bow houses as thick as they could stand. The more recent arrivals began to murmur about the first comers. None of them had been here a month yet, monopolizing everything, and contended for a redistribution of claims, cutting them down to 25 feet each, Ovando J. Hollister wrote in 1867. New York Tribune editor Horace Greeley visited the Gregory Gulch diggings on June 6th. 3 days later, the Greeley Report appeared as an extra in the Rocky Mountain News. "We have seen the gold plainly visible in the riffles of nearly every slush and in nearly every pan of the rotten quartz washed in our presence," Greeley wrote. That sealed it. There were riches beyond belief in the mountains and their clear streams, or so the miners who began rushing to the area thought. To their credit, the journalists made some attempt to head off the stampede, writing, "We charge those who manage the Telegraph not to diffuse a part of our statement without giving substantially the whole, and we beg the press generally to unite with us in warning the whole people against another rush to these gold mines as ill-advised as that of last spring." Greeley, in a June 11th letter to the New York Tribune, added, "As yet, the entire population of the valley sleeps in tents or under booths of pine boughs, cooking and eating in the open air. I doubt that there is as yet a table or chair in these diggings, eating being done around a cloth spread on the ground, while each one sits or reclines on Mother Earth." Other strikes followed on Border Creek, and then prospectors moved into South Park, closer to Pikes Peak, where they struck pay dirt on Terryall Creek. On August 13th, the Rocky Mountain News reported, "5 days ago, the rush began for South Park. Ever since, a continual stream of miners have passed through our streets. Wagons, carts, pack animals, and footmen all heading one way, all bound for the same destination, the headwaters of the Platte." Some of the prospectors who didn't find goods on Terryall Creek said the stream should have been Grab All. Later, when those same miners found gold farther west, they named their camp Fair Play, attempting to show that their practices and policies would provide equal opportunity for all gold seekers. A mining outfit. The miners who flocked to the region came primarily from four states: Ohio, Illinois, New York, and Missouri, which sent around 4,000 residents. Smaller numbers came from Connecticut, Indiana, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Virginia, and Wisconsin. When newcomers reached the gold camps, they found supplies limited and expensive. Much of the early trade came up the well-established Trapper's Trail from Taos, New Mexico. One man noted, "Flour is worth $12 per sack, 100 pounds. Groceries are rather scarce." Another added, "Bacon is worth 50 cents, flour $15 per barrel, as they get it from Taos, New Mexico, which is 300 miles from Cherry Creek." Early arrival Alexander O. McGrew on November 20, 1858, outlined plenty of business opportunities: a good drug store, a hardware store with plenty of building materials, a printing office with a good job office attached, clothing and dry goods. In fact, a general assortment would do a good business. Sheet iron is in demand. Lumber is worth 50 cents a foot, so that a good sawmill, shingle machine, and lathe cutter would do a good business. A daguerreotypist could make his fortune here at present. Let mechanics who anticipate coming bring their tools, as wages will be high. Prospector E.C. Mather, perhaps having little luck in mining but seeing the prices of food, advised, "Come out in the spring as early as possible and be sure and bring a plow and a supply of seeds. Bring a light plow, as the soil is very loose and sandy. It is well adapted to raising wheat and corn. There can be fortunes made in farming." In their complete guide to the gold districts of Kansas and Nebraska, published in Chicago on January 11, 1859, Edwin R. Peace and William Cole wrote, "A company of four can supply themselves with all necessary articles for mining and provisions for from 5 to 5.5 to 6 months, including 2 yoke of oxen and 1 wagon. For $140 per man, and a company of 6 for $120, including fares and freights from Chicago to St. Louis, to Leavenworth City. Good oxen can be bought for from $65 to $80 per yoke, and a good wagon from $75 to $80. Peace and Cole also noted that miners could travel by stage, running regularly to the mines from Omaha City early in the spring, carrying through passengers to the mines for $100 each, including meals and 50 pounds of baggage. As might be expected, there were conflicts over the value of gold. Generally, a pinch between the thumb and forefinger was valued at 25 cents, while larger amounts were weighed on a scale to determine value. But gold dust stuck to scales, fingers, thumbs, and even in the pouches miners used to transport it. To resolve differences, Clark, Gruber, and Company of Leavenworth, Kansas, established a banking house in Denver in 1860 and began minting $10 gold pieces, later also striking gold coins valued at $2.50, $5, and $20. If you don't find gold, then go back. About 90% of the estimated 100,000 prospectors and miners who sought riches as part of the Pike's Peak gold rush weren't successful, and they soon departed the region. There were so many returning to their homes that they became known as go-backs. Indeed, some never even made it to the mining region before turning tail. Go-back J.M. Newhall of Lawrence, Kansas, told of his venture in an article for the Kansas Magazine, published in Topeka in 1873. About the first day of March, A.D. 1859, four of us started for the Pike's Peak gold diggings. There were no regular diggings, nobody digging for gold, that we could see. I shoveled often in the riverbed, got lots of shining stuff, but all is not gold that glitters. We wanted to stay because we were ashamed to go back home flat broke. Eventually, Newhall did start toward home in Lawrence, later writing, "On I rolled, meeting teams once in a while, and among others, the famous one chalked in letters more than a foot long across one side of his covered wagon, 'Pike's Peak or Bust,' busted by God, was not on the other side at that time." As with most mining booms, the early rush to Colorado settled into a sustained flow, then withered before additional gold and silver claims focused attention on the region once again as new boom towns sprang up at Cripple Creek, Leadville, Georgetown, and many other locations. During the latter half of the 19th century, millions of dollars in both gold and silver came from the cold streams and underground veins of Colorado. Mining continued into the 20th century, and places like Cripple Creek still have active mines in operation. True West Magazine, August 2004. Warped Planks and Rattlesnakes by Johnny D. Boggs. If you enjoy traipsing around historic places, here are 15 sites that offer more than commercialized ghost towns full of funnel cake or other settlements that have been reduced to cacti and memories. These towns prove that the spirit of the West endures, even when the populations fade. Bannock, Montana. Montana's first capital is best known for pseudo-sheriff Henry Plummer, who wore out his welcome and got his neck stretched by vigilantes. Bannock's status as a state park has helped make it among the West's best-preserved ghost towns. Bodie, California. "Goodbye, God," a girl wrote after learning that she was moving here. "I'm going to Bodie." Or was it, "Good, by God, I'm going to Bodie." Bodie, which boomed to 10,000 folks and produced $25 million in gold and silver, remains in the top of its class. It even has its own website, www.bodie.net. Elizabethtown, New Mexico. New Mexico's first incorporated city had a checkered past, including Charles Kennedy, who murdered travelers at his place on the road to Taos. Overshadowed today by nearby resorts Angel Fire and Red River, E-Town still comes to life during summer months, especially for Gold Rush days in July. Elkhorn, Montana. Soon after its birth, around 1870, Elkhorn sported 14 saloons and was so rich, the gold and silver production is said to have totaled $14 million during the town's heyday. Today, it's a picture-perfect ghost town with store facades and warped planks. Gleason, Arizona. Sun-baked Gleason, originally named Turquoise, survived from about 1890 to 1940 as a copper mining town with a peak population of 500. The desert has reclaimed much of Gleason, although a few ruins are scattered about. Grafton, Utah. Mormons founded Grafton in 1859, intent on growing cotton. Grafton survived natural disasters and Indian uprisings, and later became a hub of not only cotton, but also silk. If the town looks familiar, picture Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Parts of it, and other movies, were filmed here. Marietta, Nevada. A boomtown for silver, then salt, and finally borate, Marietta persevered, despite 30 stagecoach robberies in 1877 until the 1920s. Today, visitors may photograph relics and ruins among sagebrush and perhaps a wild burro or two. Mogollon, New Mexico. In addition to a bonanza of silver and gold, Mogollon also produced calamitous fires in 1894, 1904, 1910, 1915, and 1942, and deadly floods in 1894, 1896, 1899, and 1914. People still live here, though. What do they do here? A visitor once asked. They hide, he was told. Pierce, Arizona. Named after Tombstone miner Jimmy Pierce, Pierce sprang to life in the 1890s around Pierce's Commonwealth Mine, which he sold for $250,000. Before the mines closed in 1930, 1,500 called Pierce home. Only a few live here today, but Pierce does have a museum and a post office. Shakespeare, New Mexico. Originally known as Mexican Springs, about 200 hardy souls carved out a brutal existence here in 1884, but the death of silver mining turned this into a ghost town. Privately owned, Shakespeare is well intact despite a 1997 fire, and open for tours on select dates. Shafter, Texas. Named after lard-ass martinet William Shafter, this Chinati Mountains settlement served this as the silver capital of Texas from 1880 to 1942. Many ruins remain, along with a few diehard residents, not to mention rattlesnakes. Silver City, Idaho. Talk about rich. The poor man's mine's ore assayed at $5,000 a ton. Despite losing the county seat in 1935, Silver City and its historic Idaho Hotel remain popular tourist destinations today. Silver Plume, Colorado. This picturesque settlement boomed from the early 1870s, surviving a fire in 1884 before succumbing more or less to the Panic of 1893. False-fronted streets and an interesting graveyard are among the highlights of this Georgetown Loop Railroad site. South Pass City, Wyoming. A leader in the women's suffrage movement, the first female justice of the peace held court here in 1870, South Pass controlled western Wyoming until the mines quickly played out. Several restored structures at the state's historic site, however, preserve its legacy. Terlingua, Texas. Beginning in the 1880s, production of quicksilver brought life to Big Bend country. The dusty ruins draw plenty of tourists, perhaps even a few who have never heard of the internationally famous championship chili cook-offs held there. True West. August 2004 edition. Calamity Jane by Jana Bommersback. Calamity Jane, yes, there really was such a person in the Old West, wasn't the glamour puss as Jean Arthur portrayed her in 1936's The Plainsman. But she also wasn't the silly twit of Doris Day's 1953 movie. She wasn't the West's Joan of Arc of dime novels or the Black Hills Florence Nightingale of early newspaper articles, nor was she the Lady Robin Hood of someone's fantasies. But she also wasn't just a whore, as some have tried to dismiss her. Martha Cannery actually was a complicated woman who didn't always buy into society's constraints or sense of ladies' fashion, and therefore was suspect. In all the existing material written about Calamity Jane, there is a remarkable hesitation to condemn her, in spite of the fact that her sexual irregularities and drunken escapades were prodigious and well-known. Biographer Roberta Bede Soled says. So it is no accident that HBO's new hit, Deadwood, presents Calamity Jane as just one of the few sympathetic characters. And speaking of Deadwood, the real town in the mid-1800s, it's eye-opening to see how Calamity Jane was regarded. In 1895, she returned to town after an absence of 16 years. Here's how the Black Hills Daily Times reported it. She has always been known for her friendliness, generosity, and happy, cordial manner. It didn't matter to her whether a person was rich or poor, white or black, or what their circumstances were. Calamity Jane was just the same to all. Her purse was always open to help a hungry fellow, and she was one of the first to proffer her help in cases of sickness, accidents, or any distress. But after some townsfolk were outraged at such laudatory verbiage, the paper changed its tune, and a month later atoned for its indiscretion by referring to Calamity as a notorious ruin, Soled notes. That whiplash of impressions was common, she says, recounting why the rough-and-ready days of Deadwood's boom suited this rough-and-ready woman who preferred men's clothing. Her spasmodic generosity, her brusque, rough sympathy for the underdog, her failure to be impressed with riches, fine clothes, or society, her lack of pretense or affectation of virtue, her complete rejection of simpering femininity, such attributes were esteemed on the frontier. She was a symbol of rough virtue, hardiness with a heart of gold, and a lively sense of humor. Few were anywhere near the scene of her activities were in the least deceived about her status as a kind of eccentric prostitute. Nowhere in the record is there approval of her aberrations, but there is much support for the view that her virtues outweighed her vices. That helps explain why Deadwood gave her one of the biggest funerals in the town's history, and the New York Times memorialized her as the most eccentric and picturesque character in the West. Rough beginning. Martha Cannery was born in 1856, not 1852 as she claimed, in Princeton, Missouri. Her father was a gambler, and her mother was of the lowest grade. The family moved to Montana Territory when Martha was a little girl, and some say the parents abandoned their children. In her autobiography, Calamity intimates the family was together until her mother died in 1866. And then a year later, after having moved to Utah, her father died. She and her siblings went to Wyoming, and after that, she makes no mention of her family. If she ever saw her sisters again, she never said. Soled says when the Union Pacific pushed through Wyoming in 1868, Calamity began her life of following the construction camps. If that year is correct, Calamity became a camp follower at age 12, but was passing herself off as 16. She always claimed that just 2 years later, she was a scout for the Army. Joined General Custer as a scout at Fort Russell, Wyoming, in 1870, and started for Arizona for the Indian Campaign, says Calamity in the autobiography she dictated to someone who knew how to write. There are several big problems with that sentence, Solid notes. Custer wasn't in Fort Russell and never set foot in Arizona. In 1870, he was at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, writing his war memoirs. Solid says there's no real proof Calamity was ever employed as a scout or guide, although postcards showing her in those professions are on sale to this day in Western tourist shops. What is clear is that she had to support herself most of her life. While she often hooked up with men, few supported her, and the unions didn't last long. She claimed to have married Clinton Burke in August 1885 in El Paso, and then remained in Texas, leading a quiet home life until 1889. Problem is, Solid notes, Calamity wasn't in El Paso in 1885 and is found throughout the West during the next few years. Later scholars have found a marriage certificate showing she was married to a railway brakeman she met in Wyoming named Bill Steers. She had two children, a boy who died in infancy, and a daughter who lived into the 1960s. She earned her living for years as a bullwhacker, as she claimed, and some insisted she was outstanding when driving a team of horses. Whatever her skills with reins or a gun, newspapers throughout the West kept track of her comings and goings, showing that her movements were of interest to a general population. That interest led to a short career in the limelight, when she appeared in Minneapolis in 1896, wearing buckskin trousers and boots with such high heels she could barely walk in them. The show was touted, the famous woman scout of the Wild West. Heroine of a thousand thrilling adventures, the terror of evildoers in the Black Hills, the comrade of Buffalo Bill and Wild Bill Hickok. See this famous woman and hear her graphic depictions of her daring exploits. How long that stint lasted and what happened to her in the next few years is unknown. Her next venture into show business was in 1901 at the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, New York. At that time, Calamity was found living in Montana, sick and half dead from a long drunk, Solid reports. Calamity was talked into going east, promising not to take a drink without informing her chaperone, which didn't keep her from drinking, but did keep the chaperone hopping. Some reports say she stole the show on horseback. Others say she drove a team of six horses. But this gig didn't last long either, and she made her way back to Montana. From Martha to Calamity. There are many stories of how she got the name Calamity Jane. An early one has her telling Jesse James it came because bad luck seemed to follow Pretty Jane. But in her autobiography, she claims she got it in the Indian Wars when she saved a captain during an ambush. Far more likely is that it just happened. Jane was a common name for any woman in the West. It was the name Lewis and Clark called Sacagawea, and her life was a calamity compared to the life women were expected to pursue. The name certainly fit perfectly into the fanciful dime novels that started appearing about her life in 1877. She was the heroine in perhaps 10 different novels by writer Edward L. Wheeler. All helped spread her reputation and made her a household name, even though the books were fiction. But anyone who spent time trying to separate truth from myth about any Western icon shouldn't be surprised that the same applied to this woman, who some applaud as living life on her terms and the honored tradition of individuality. Jane and Wild Bill? It seems she loved him fiercely, although Wild Bill Hickok didn't reciprocate. They were, however, friends, and she would long mourn his murder on August 2, 1876. But what she couldn't get in life, she did get in death, ironically dying exactly one day short of 27 years after him. Calamity Jane is buried near Wild Bill in the Deadwood Cemetery. They are together in death, even if they were never really together in life. And to this day, when anyone wants to represent the blunt grit of a woman of the West, Calamity Jane, real or imagined, comes immediately to mind.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.